All right, welcome viewers. With us today are Patrick Sturgis. Patrick? And Courtney Kennedy. And we will talk today about political polls. So political polls are polls where about stuff where people can win something, usually. Elections, referenda. So I'll quickly introduce the speakers before we dive into the topic. So Patrick Sturgis is Professor of Quantitative Social Science at the London School of Economics. And he's here with us today because he led the inquiry into the 2015 general election polls in the United Kingdom. And for those of you who forgot all about this episode, this was the election where the Conservatives were predicted to have a very close election with Labour, but in the end, the Conservatives won the election. So he led this inquiry, and there is a very nice paper that came out of this inquiry that you can read about in the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society A. So if you, after this podcast, feel like you want to read more about all the interesting stuff that Patrick is going to say, do read the paper. It's recommended. So the other person with us is Courtney Kennedy. She is the Director of Survey Research for Pew, and she also led an inquiry, but then the inquiry in the United States after the 2016 election results. And you may remember that as the election where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton narrowly, and especially in some states, Trump outperformed his pre-election polling estimates. So, political polls. Patrick and Courtney, can you tell us a bit about polls? So how good or how bad are political polls generally in the United States and the United Kingdom? And I'll start with Courtney.
Sure. Well, I would start by saying, when I think of political polls, I would actually use a slightly broader definition. That you know, to your point, captures election polls where the focus is on the horse race, but also maybe more public opinion type polls that are looking at how do people feel about the candidates, what issues are on people's minds, you know, during an election, how do people feel about important public policies and so forth. Because to answer your question, I think there's an important distinction there. We've certainly seen recently in the United States, but in a lot of other countries, a lot of partisanship, polarization, leading in some cases to very competitive elections, right? And when you have those very tight elections, I think we do see that this tool of polling is limited, and it often cannot be as precise in sort of indicating the right winners as people want it to be. So I'd give you one answer specifically about election polls in close elections. I'm not going to overstate how accurate and predictive they are, because I think, you know, the real caution is needed there. But the thing is, a lot of people take that and you know, jump to the conclusion that all political polls don't work anymore. It's all you know, broken. And I feel very strongly that that is not the case. I think as a tool that we as social scientists have, polling actually still works quite well to get these high level reads about where the public is at on policies and major issues of the day. It's not perfect, right? We might be off by 3, 4, 5 points, but the tool is still good enough to tell us, you know, majority, minority support, and some of the important contours of opinion. And we see that when we, you know, benchmark against other outcomes that are not elections, and there's other evidence to support, you know, the argument that polls work, but just, you know, not necessarily for competitive elections. Patrick, I don't know if that lines up with
you. Yeah, that very, very much rings true with me, Courtney. I mean, my involvement with polling, I was not someone who is a kind of a poll watcher, you know, the sophologist types who know every election result in every county going back to the late 60s. And I think that was one of the reasons why the British Polling Council asked me to do it, because I'm more a standard survey methodologist. And in truth, when I looked into it and what the methodologies were, my question was not, how do they get it wrong, but how do they get it right? You know, I mean, this is this is a really difficult thing to do. You know, it's a very high difficulty tariff in those terms, in time trying to estimate a finite population quantity. It's kind of a moving target. You've got the turnout issue as well. Everything is more difficult than some other things we often try and estimate in surveys. My overall impression is that polls do a good job historically. Occasionally they go wrong, and that's when we get called in to do inquiries and the big attention is paid to them. But they do, in the long run, and most of the time, do a much better job than anything else that's available to us. As part of our inquiry, and I know, Courtney, that in your April report, you looked at some of the historical error rates and so on. And we found, I think, on average, around the two main parties were about 2 points off. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, the margin is a little bit bigger, more like 4% on the lead tends to be the average error, but that's pretty good, right? And I think that's one of the things that we tried to do in our inquiry was to kind of get that across to the public, was that there's often this view that pollsters are kind of, you know, got their thumbs on the scale and they're in the pay of the politicians and their skullduggery. And we were kind of like, no, their incentives aren't stacked in that direction. They're trying to do the best of a difficult job and learn as they go along. And they tend to do reasonably well, with the odd exception. And those exceptions are not necessarily the statistical outliers. They're the ones where they get the result wrong. You know, so again, if you've got a close election, you could have a sort of mean absolute error that's lower than an election where they get it right. No one cares then. It's only when the expectations are let down. So yeah, I think our experiences chime pretty well, I think.
Yeah, so one reason why I think the two of you are here is especially for this reason, that in the UK and the US, with a first-past-the-post political system, misses are often, like elections are often tight, especially recently. And so any polling miss in any direction can quickly like lead to a different result. And in other countries with a more proportional system, say Germany or the Netherlands or Italy or some other country, there may also be polling misses, right? But then the polling misses go in all kinds of directions. So some parties are a bit overpolled and some are a bit underpolled. But if these parties are from the same political family, it really doesn't really affect, for example, who gets to be in government after the election, which is often what elections are ultimately about, right? So yes. Having said that, though, I'm wondering whether you can tell a bit more about the particular cases that these two quite high-profile misses, right? So in the UK, there were actually two cases, right? So there was the general election, and after that, there was also the UK referendum about EU membership. And in the US, I think there have been some other cases of what in the media tends to be reported as polling misses. So given your involvement in some of these recent committees that have evaluated polling, what were the findings from your committee? Courtney, can I start with you?
Sure. Right. So the big stories in the US have been the 2016 election, which you talked a bit about, and then the one we recently had in 2020 in the fall, when Joe Biden became president or was elected. So for us, the 2016 and 2020 elections, the polling, to the extent that there were polling errors, there were some similarities, but some differences. The thing that's concerning is that for us in both of those presidential elections, when there were errors, they tended to be in the same direction of, overestimating left-wing Democratic support and underestimating support for Donald Trump. And so while that's just two data points, you know, if you look at it in this global context, there does seem to be this sort of, it has the feeling of a systematic thing where what I would say the methodological weakness in polls right now, especially online polls, but also telephone polls, this methodological weakness of getting more likely to reach more educated folks who tend to lean more left, is sort of lining up in this really problematic way with politics. So that it used to be in the US that, you know, whether you were a Democrat or a Republican was not really a strong predictor of whether you would take a survey. I think it was that way for decades. And it does feel like that's what's changed, you know, since roughly about 2016. We do see now a lot of evidence that Republicans tend to be less likely to take surveys than Democrats. And with the 2016 election report, based on the data, it was my hope and I think the view of the committee that, well, if you did this adjustment, if you made sure that the education distribution was correct, you weighted down, you know, college graduates and weighted up the less educated who are more Republican, that you might remove that differential partisan bias. Unfortunately, what we saw with 2020 is that, you know, doing that education weighting, it helps. It's a good thing to do, but it does not at all completely fix this. So it seems in the US context that we still have the sort of differential partisan non-response going on, even with some, you know, basic weighting corrections. And unfortunately, even within party. So even if you get the right share of Dems and reps, you know, weighted in your poll, the Republicans in particular, who seem to be more likely to take surveys these days, don't seem to be very representative of Republicans across the country. And so the APOR, you know, in 2020 did another report. I personally didn't serve on this committee, but I've been in touch with them and they talked about their results at APOR. And they had this fascinating finding that, so if you take the US polls from 2020, and you want to figure out what does it take to make these polls get the election perfect, as opposed to having a Democratic bias, which most of them did. And the committee did the simulation and they found out that in order to nail the Biden-Trump number in a 2020 poll, if you look at what your respondents said they did in 2016, you had to weight it such that Trump won in 2016 by 12 points when he actually lost nationally by 2 in our popular vote. So all that's to say, there's just really strong evidence that these Republicans who are taking surveys are not terribly representative. So we do have a lingering partisan non-response issue, unfortunately. And I think in the US, we're still trying to figure out how to overcome it. Patrick, what are you having in the UK there?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a very potted overview of the last 5 elections and polling for them in the UK. But actually, again, quite similar, I think, headline story, which is really that it comes down to the representativeness of samples. It's a kind of sample composition issue. Not a lot of the other things that people tend to like immediately gravitate to as the explanation. So in 2015, and as Peter said, you can read all the detail of this in our paper on it. But we kind of approached it from a kind of, you know, like a murder inquiry. Here are the suspects, line them up. Is it turnout weighting? Is it people, shy Tories, you know, people misreporting who they're going to vote for? And we went through all of the possible candidates and kind of ruled them out one by one. And that sort of left us with the representativeness of the samples as really the only plausible explanation. And we were able to kind of back that up with some other analyses, which we compared to benchmarks and showed that there were sample skews in important ways. What we didn't get into there really, I mean, maybe this was a bit of a trick of how we approached it to make our lives easier. We didn't say why, you know, that's the big question, right? You know, the samples contain too many Labour voters, not enough Conservatives, but the big question that we want to know and how to fix it is why. So that was 2015. And there was one other thing about 2015 that I think made a big difference, made it such a surprise, was that it was the low variance in the estimates of the lead. So we found some evidence that the pollsters were kind of herding, not in a deliberate way, we didn't think, but just in these like decisions that they have to make about waiting and turnout and so on that led them all to kind of herd into a safe direction. And that meant that the level of surprise was that much greater, because all the polls are telling us the same thing. If we had a few over here and a few there, that would have been different. So that was 2015, and we wrote our report on it. Immediately we had the EU referendum. And that's interesting, because I think, as Peter sort of mentioned, it's seen as another big polling miss. But actually, I don't think it is. I think that one is much more a failure of the commentariat to interpret what was going on. Here I am, you can see I'm wearing my EU T-shirt. This was the one I was wearing on the night of the referendum. So no clues for guessing what side I was on. And I think there was a kind of, you know, perhaps a... We had this difference between the phone polls and the online polls. And the online polls, they were all kind of showing it's a dead heat. But the online polls were showing Leave slightly ahead, and the phone polls were showing Remain with a bit of a healthier lead. Again, maybe some of the sort of issues you're talking about, Courtney, in terms of kind of people who respond to requests to do surveys and so on. But then I think people looked at that and they were like, well, those ones have to be right. But if you look at those numbers now, and John Curtis in the UK has pointed this out, you look at those numbers now, you wouldn't say, you know, any confidence about calling a Remain win. But it was still another sort of a problem for the pollsters. They got another bit of a kicking over that. Then we had 2017, and what happened there was that the polls did not as badly, but still not very well. But in effect, they overcorrected for a problem that they could manage to make an adjustment for, and that was turnout weighting. So in 2017, they switched to using turnout models. So they were using the turnout model from 2015 to predict turnout in 2017, rather than just using self-reported likelihood to turn out on a 1 to 10 scale, which they traditionally did. And unfortunately, this was one of our recommendations in the 2015 inquiry, that they should move in this direction, and it didn't work. So had they stuck to their original methods rather than listen to our recommendations, they would have done better in 2017. But there you go. I mean, that's another thing that I think I've learned from this, is that it's always a moving target. You're never going to settle on the right way of doing polling. It's a dynamic between, you know, technology, methodology, society, politics. Another reason why it's incredibly difficult. And then just to top off my kind of not great record, in 2019, I wrote an article in The Guardian saying this is going to be the hardest election to poll in living memory. And the pollsters all got it pretty much right. One of the most accurate sets of polls that we've seen for a long, long time. Why they did that, why it was, we don't really know, because we only have inquiries when things go badly. Maybe they've finessed their methods, maybe they got lucky, but that's the story of what's happened in the UK in recent elections.
All right, I want to pick up on something that I think Courtney pointed to. So there's this hypothesis that you often see in the media, that there is something called like a shy Tory vote or a shy Trump vote, or you can fill in your party in your own country, like the party that is maybe has some sort of social stigma that people are afraid to tell to pollsters that they are to vote for Trump or for the Tories. And I think a lot of the research so far has pointed out that people are generally quite honest, right? What they are going to vote. So this measurement error problem that if you ask the question that people just will lie to the pollster, that I don't think that there's a lot of evidence for this, but what Courtney was just polling to is a sort of another shy Trump vote. That would be that Trump voters themselves are less likely maybe to participate in polls at all, right? So if you think about a missing data mechanism, that you have a missing not at data, missing not at random mechanism, that people are missing exactly for the reason that they are voting for Trump, right? Or for Republicans generally. And I think there is some evidence of this for this also from some other countries. So one of the advantages of a more proportional system is that there's lots of different parties. So I'm from the Netherlands, where we have at the moment 19 different parties in parliament. lots of different ones, but also some that are very, let's say, at the edge of the political system, where a lot of where there is some sort of social stigma if you would vote for these kind of parties. And I think there is some evidence that it's particularly hard to poll for these particular parties. So what is it? Is it really, would you say that that we have this case, that there is, that there are particular subgroups of the electorates that are getting harder and harder to poll? Is it maybe something that is lacking in our polling methods, right? So is it a case that if we maybe use a different method that we would be able to reach particular parts of the electorate? Or are we missing particular covariates, right? So is it the case that if we would wait on a different variable, so maybe we can wait for turnout, or we can wait for a level of education, right? So both these things have recently been tried, but maybe we're missing, right? The magical covariate that if only we would have that variable, everything would go well. So this is very bad to do in podcasting, right? To ask three questions at once. So the first question is, do you think that there is this case that we are having troubles reaching a particular subgroup of the electorate in the US and in the UK?
I think so. I'm glad you talked about the shy Tory, you know, shy Trump thing, because I think it's a really important distinction whether this is mostly measurement error or whether it's mostly non-response error. Those are fundamentally different problems with very different potential solutions. And I agree with your summary. The committee for the 2016 US election that I served on, we did 5 different tests to try to look for and test the shy Trump hypothesis. And each one turned up no evidence whatsoever, or very little evidence in support of that. So, and other scholars since then have done other analyses and found broadly the same thing. So I'm pretty convinced that this is mostly a non-response problem. Not to say that we don't have any measurement error and nobody lies, of course that's not true, but I think the majority of the errors is non-response. And you know, you talked about is there some sort of magical covariate that's out there that we just need to find? I feel like I kind of walked into that trap, you know, in 2016. That was a little bit of what, you know, our thinking regarding this education adjustment, right? If you just get that right, you know, maybe you've really fixed this issue. And it didn't bear out. So I'm very pessimistic, frankly, that it's as simple as finding a variable, whether it's like social trust or, you know, trust in institutions, whether it's something that simple that we just need to wait for. I think that it's something deeper, at least in the US, because in the US, you know, maybe not everybody is aware, but Donald Trump, when he was in the presidency, he would often speak out, you know, against the entire polling field and specific, you know, high profile pollster and media outlets in particular. And it was just overtly critical of the industry. And, you know, we know that people will take those cues, right, from their political leaders. And so it makes sense that in the US, you had sort of like half the country, the more Republican half of the country, internalizing this message. Polls are bad, you know, they're antagonistic towards our guy, and we're not going to participate. And so, you know, I think what we're trying to deal with is how, if that's really the effect that we're dealing with, is that going to persist for years and years, or might that effect wear off relatively quickly now that Trump is out of office? I don't think we really know yet, but I'm convinced it's kind of a deeper, trickier issue than just one variable.
Yeah, I mean, I again, you won't be surprised. I find the shy voters, shy Trump, shy Tory thing, it's something that is the go-to explanation for the first people into the first commentators on the TV. It's people lying about because they're, and people always worry about it beforehand, but really there are so many things about it that don't stack up theoretically, and there's no good evidence to support it. I mean, in our report, we looked at the fact that people, we went back to people with recontact surveys and asked them, who did you vote for? And there was still the same polling error. Were they going to lie before and after? And we could compare the results to post-election surveys that got the result about right and that the people don't. So there's all sorts of inconsistencies as a theory. However, it makes much more sense that there are factors that are going to mean the response is affected by political persuasion, and that is something that can manifest in different ways. Some of them are kind of like, as you say, the really obvious thing about Trump saying we hate pollsters, don't respond to polls is a very obvious political thing. But it could be much more subtle things like COVID. Maybe Democrat voters more likely to be at home because they've been furloughed than a Republican, and so lots of things correlate with politics. And so I'm a bit more on the kind of, I think these are sort of cyclical things that move around. You might get a couple of elections in a row where the direction is the same. We have in the UK always had this kind of tendency to underestimate the Tory vote and overestimate the Labour vote, and that was the rule until it wasn't in 2017 when the thing reversed and they overestimated Labour. So on the kind of the magic bullet waiting variable, again, that's a sort, someone will emerge every now and again saying, I found the secret waiting variable. Maybe it was Courtney with education back in 2016. But we had in the UK 2015, there was a lot of interest in political engagement, because it's very clear that non-probability panel samples are massively over-engaged. So that's just if we correct for that, then everything's going to be fine. Now, as you mentioned, trust, people are interested in social trust. It's the people who don't trust them. One of the problems with that is where are you weighting totals? What are you weighting to? You get these kind of mushy totals. You've got an online poll, and maybe your benchmark is from a big face-to-face survey that was done 5 years ago. So I think that, there be dragons. I don't think I would be wanting to go in that direction in the unlikely event that I were a pollster.
Right. I mean, we talked quite a lot already about waiting, right? So this is a podcast about waiting after all, maybe. But waiting plays a large role, right, in political polling nowadays. So it's not the case anymore that you can just do a survey and you get a good response rate and you if you don't wait, you're fine, right? Waiting is a necessity. For probability-based surveys, but also for all the kinds of other surveys that are around, right? Robo polls and telephone polls and all these kind of things. So is there a difference between all these different polling methods? So are, in some ways, some methods better than other methods? Or like what, yeah. So how do you view this, Patrick? Is it true that telephone polls historically have been, I think, until quite recently, the mainstay of a lot of the political polling. But more recently, I think firms have switched to the internet for cost and time reasons, all kinds of reasons. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think actually one of the things I was interested to discover when I was doing the polling program, we did do some kind of comparative just looking at what different countries do. And there are very kind of strong methodological traditions within countries. So for example, in the US, until recently, and I'd be interested to hear what Courtney says about this, is that there was a real strong focus on random sampling for polling. I think that's still there, but seems to be dying out a bit. But that, I think, came from the 1948 polling inquiry, where the big conclusion was that the error had come because you were using these poor quality, and random sampling was the big solution to this. And that's been a big kind of driver of APOR and everything. But so that's an interesting trend, the fact that that tradition is dying. We've never had that in the UK. We've never done random sample polls. It was always, face-to-face quota and telephone quota. Now I think there's only one or two pollsters that use phone polling. That's obviously not, I mean, it's kind of quasi-random, but not really. So the vast majority of polls are online opt-in panels that do various amounts of modeling and weighting. And it seems to be, I have to profess I'm not an expert on this part of it, but it does seem that the pollsters like YouGov that have an established panel and know a lot about their panelists, so they can kind of invite people based on characteristics, and then they've got a lot of things that they can weight by without asking questions. That seems to me to give them quite an advantage in a model-based world of estimation.
I think that's right. In the US, I would broadly agree with sort of the evolution that you described, but I wouldn't say that probability is died out or even dying out. So my take on it is, yes, if you go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, it was pretty much uniformly random sampling of telephone numbers in the US. And then in the early 2000s, you did see a massive segment of the polling industry go online, without a doubt. But there are, I think, two exceptions, though. So there remains a core group of some of the highest profile media pollsters that have not gone that route. So Fox, CNN, ABC, and a number of others are still doing probability-based methods. And right now you're seeing a real mix of online panels with probability-based samples, random sampling of addresses, or some legacy RDD or live telephone sampling random phone numbers or phone numbers from voter registration records. So you've got that group. And then the other interesting group are sort of like the campaign pollsters themselves, who, from what I can tell, have largely kind of come to the conclusion that these opt-in panels don't really fit their need, because the populations that they're surveying are so geographically small, you can't get enough of the people in the groups they need to survey with these online panels. So they're still sampling, doing random samples off of registered voter files. So I think in the US, we still have two important groups in the polling industry that are still doing basically probability-based methods. In 2020, I do think has the potential to be a bit of a watershed year for us in the US, because it seemed to be the year where live telephone really struggled. Not to say that no one's going to do it anymore, but the people I know that had been doing live telephone in 2020 are looking seriously at other approaches. And one, just zooming out a little bit more broadly about modes and how they're working. At Pew Research Center, we've got an online panel in the US. We recruit to it by randomly sampling addresses. But everybody's interviewed online. If you don't have internet, we give you a tablet. So we try to cover those folks. And that works, it works pretty well. We've been happy with it. But even panels like that, which are very expensive, hard to create, they are prone to having this democratic bias. And so I see it in other panels in the US that are built in a similar way. And the trick is, how do we fix that now? Right? Like, to Patrick's point, where are the benchmarks to get the partisan balance right? And one thing that we're doing is, I'm convinced that if you want to get a good party number in the US now, you can't just do it online. You can't just do it with live phone. You have to have some other offline mode. And in our case, we're trying to do a survey where you give people the option of a mail, pen and paper mail survey, or if they want to go online, that's fine. But what I know for sure is that if you just do online, even probability-based, if you just do online, you're going to get way too many Democrats, and you have to do something about it if you're a serious election pollster.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's interesting because of the way the market is changing, and we have been seeing the emergence of the you know online probability panels or mixed mode panels, and we were a bit slow starting in the UK. I think we've now got three, and using different approaches, it's kind of they're not really used for political polling. I think the sort of market for them is kind of interesting and developing. It's that sort of that question I know Pew have looked at is what do you get from this? You know, it's going to be more expensive and not particularly more accurate, and sometimes possibly less accurate. So why would you want to go down this route? I guess, I mean, that's something you might want to comment on, Courtney, but for me, I think there's a lot of, you know, you want to know where the data come from. That's the thing. I think for a lot of the online non-probability panels, it is a bit of a wild west. It's just kind of trying to grab people anywhere you can on the internet. They're the same people being stuffed through. So, and you, if someone says, well, where did you get these people? You actually don't know. Whereas with your Pew panel, you can actually explain, you know, we've got a list of everyone in the country. Maybe a very small proportion of them ended up taking part, and we're trying to deal with that. But you can explain that whole where the data came from issue. But yeah, I think this is an Ezra podcast, right? So we're interested in those kind of developments. But certainly in the UK, I don't think they're going to be used for vote intention polls. Partly because of the fact that in the field period, if you want to include those kind of offliners, I think in the UK there's two that use phone for the offliners and one that you give them a tablet. Giving them a tablet, I guess, the problem there is that they're no longer the offline population, right? They've become online, but they're probably going to start using it for other things. And you lose a lot of people who just don't want to, they can't figure out how to use it and so on. So it seems to me that using some of those more traditional, mail, paper and pencil and phone probably give you a bit of a better edge there. But when you look at it, because they're only a small part of the full sample, it never makes a huge difference, right? So it's always marginal to include those groups anyway. But yeah, I think that's the situation in the UK on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you raise what I think is a really good question, which is like, you know, what is the argument, the value add, right, of going to the great expense and hassle of doing an online panel that's probability based. And to my mind, there's really two important answers. You know, one you talked about is just being able to explain the process from a serious, transparent, scientific perspective, but also being able to fix things, right? If you are beholden to a vendor that's got a black box, convenient sample methodology, you know, as a researcher, as a client, you have, you know, usually zero control, zero ability to try to improve that process, you know, who's the representation of your sample that we talked about earlier. If though you're working, you know, you have a panel or you're working with a vendor that has a panel that is at least starts with a probability-based sample, then you have much more leverage and ability to try things out, to experiment with different protocols, different modes, all sorts of different stuff. So I think in terms of like, you know, trying to fix errors, you're in a much better footing, right? If you're working with a probability approach. The other one that I've become really fixated on in the last few years is the data quality, is who's responding to your surveys, and are they just in it to game a system and make money sort of on the side? Or are they, you know, really legitimately, you know, trying to give you their opinions? Because in the US, there was a fascinating example in the 2016 election. You know, there was a bunch of people on the Democratic side who were vying to be that Democratic candidate. It was ultimately Joe Biden, right? But there were others that were running. And one of the Democratic candidates on her website, they said to her supporters, look, these online panels, one in particular, one of the high profile opt-in online panels that everybody knows, this panel is being used to determine who gets to be in the nationally televised debate. So everybody, all these supporters, go sign up for this opt-in panel so that we can increase our candidate's standing in the polls, and hopefully she can get into the debate. So, I mean, and I don't know that that one incident in particular had any consequences for anything, but it just gives you a real world example of the potential for stuff to go sideways, right? When you are using an opt-in process, well, where virtually anybody can sign themselves up. Mm. And so probability sampling, it does, you know, it's not perfect, but it protects us greatly from that kind of problem.
Yeah, I mean, you've effectively got a random sample of the kind of people who are going to do that, right? Whereas in the opt-in, you're inviting people in to kind of, you know, create all kind of mischief and do things purely for the monetary return. Now, and of course, the panel operators will say, well, we have methods for detecting these people and so on, but it's a bit of a kind of arms race, isn't it? Can they?
Well, I'm not saying that their methods are super great. You know, we did a huge study a couple of years ago and we found that, you know, significant numbers made their way through these fancy checks, right? So like even after they did their fancy checks, 5% of the cases in online opt-in were bogus. And not just bogus, but they systematically just say that they like everything. It's a this sort of positivity effect, which you know can introduce some bias into estimates. And you know, again, if you're just doing market research or something, it probably doesn't really matter. Or if you're not looking at the poll through a fine microscope, you might not notice this thing. But you know, the potential is definitely there, and it's certainly the case that the checks that these vendors have had in place don't catch everybody.
I want to pick up on the sort of positive thing for probability polling here that we're getting to slowly. So in, I know that at Ezra there's lots of research being presented from these kind of probability based panels. So lots of countries run these. So for example, in Germany there's a mixed mode probability based panel that uses both online and mail actually modes. For the offliners, in some other countries, they give people tablets. There's all kinds of variations of these kind of panels. But generally, these are not being used, right, for polling, because it takes a lot of time and effort, right, to run this, and you have this issue of timing. So would you think that it would help polling and methodology if these panels would start doing more political polling? It's also like a high-profile thing, right? So if you get it wrong, imagine you're a panel, you do this, and then you get the election results wrong.
I think in theory, I'd always be in favor of someone with a rigorous tool, you know, doing election work. The thing that I've seen kind of go sideways, though, is the people like who work at GASIS or, you know, who work at some of these really top shelf panels in Europe or even in the US, people who do those types of panels don't always know election polling. And I've seen in the US, I'll say, I've seen examples of people who do this sort of more government type work, really high level work really well, try to do election polling and frankly make some mistakes because they don't have experience in it. So like doing odd likely voter models, doing odd weighting, doing odd weight trimming. So in theory, yes, but you really have to have somebody who knows election polling and knows the ins and outs and the intricacies of that and pair that with this tool. But if you only have the tool of the panel, I'm not terribly confident that they'll get the best results if they don't know, you know, elections per se.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I mean, I would, if I was running one of those panels myself, I think I'd be very tempted to put in a vote intention question, just as a good, it's one of the few good ways that you can calibrate your methodology, and then maybe I'd publish it if we got close to the result, but after the event.
So this is one direction, right, where polling can head. So I want to look at a bit into the future. So this is one potential way. What do you think is, because currently I agree with you, Patrick, that it's a bit of a wild west of methods, right, and things that people are doing. So Do you see sort of methods converging in the future to a point, or are we moving towards a new sort of golden standard for polling, or will the Wild West just continue and everyone will just try and hit and miss? Courtney, any?
I think that the Wild West, or, you know, to my mind, just tremendous variation, right, in how polling is done is going to persist for a while, because the forces that made online opt-in popular are with us for the foreseeable future. With the, you know, cost being the big one, but timeliness also important. So you've got those forces. But then, you know, as Patrick was talking about, you do have sort of a different set of researchers and organizations for whom it does make sense to invest in probability sampling. And I think that those forces and recognition of people for whom those, you know, those marginal data quality issues can matter, they're going to want to continue to invest in probability sampling, I think, at least in the near term. So I'm expecting sort of both of those methodologies to carry forward for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I never make predictions, especially about the future, as the saying goes. I don't say this with any confidence, but I think that we're going to just keep kind of experimenting around the same approach of getting samples of people and asking them questions. I don't have a lot of confidence that we're going to see something radically different. Obviously, there's been quite a lot of excitement about social media and Twitter and so on, and rightly so. I don't want to be, you know, raining on that parade, but it hasn't been, looked very promising, really. And when you think about the challenges, even more so doing things in that way. So I do think generally we're going to be asking people samples of people questions in one way or another for the foreseeable future, which is like good for Ezra and our community of researchers.
All right, so I think we're drawing to an end. Any last thoughts or messages that you want to give to the Ezra people, Patrick?
Well, yeah, I mean, I hope it'll be a great conference. I'll be there for as much of it as I can be. Looks like a great program. Shame we can't all be together. Hopefully that will change, certainly by 2023, which I guess is when the next one would be due. So enjoy the conference, everyone.
Thanks. Courtney?
Oh, I would just second that. Ezra is a fabulous conference. I think I'm planning to wait till the next in-person one, whenever that is, and I look forward to seeing everyone and wish everybody a wonderful conference.
All right, that's the same for me. So thank you all for listening. Enjoy the rest of Ezra, and let's hope that we can meet again in real life soon. Thanks.